I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, when you think about poverty in this country, you might think about certain people living in certain places. It turns out that some of those old assumptions are wrong. For example, more poor people now live in the suburbs. We'll talk about why that is in just a few minutes. But first, we want to turn to that big story about the Internal Revenue Service. The agency has become a big headache for the Obama administration after the IRS acknowledged that some of its personnel looked for words like Tea Party or Patriot when nonprofit groups were seeking tax-exempt status. Those groups then got extra attention in the screening process. We wanted to take a step back and talk about some of the history and the politics behind the issue. Why, for example, do some nonprofits have tax-exempt status, and why are they banned from political activity to begin with? We found two journalists who've been covering the issue. David K. Johnston is a columnist for the nonprofit news group Tax Analyst. He's also a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and law professor at Syracuse University. He joins us from NPR member station WXXI in Rochester, New York. David K. Johnston, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also with us, Brenton Mock. He's a reporter for ColorLines.com. He's with us from member station WWNO in New Orleans. Brenton, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, David K. Johnston, I'm going to start with you. I think that most reasonable people would agree that the IRS rules are confusing. And even the Treasury Inspector General's report said that some IRS employees didn't understand the rules that they had to base decisions on. So can you just briefly tell us why certain nonprofits get tax-exempt status and some don't? Is there some standard or some rule of thumb that you can point us to?
Well, there are 25 nonprofit sections, and they govern everything from the traditional charities that we think about, like United Way, to little mutual insurance companies, to the National Football League. The particular one at issue, 501c4, dates to 1913, and the law says, the statute says, it is exclusively to promote social welfare. The IRS, 1959, adopted a regulation that said, primarily, you have to do social welfare, and this was done apparently so that if you were an advocate group for, say, more bicycle riding, you could go to the city council and say, please adopt rules and design streets so they're friendly to bicycles. Nobody thought it would be partisan political activity, and that's what caused the problem for the IRS. They got applications for groups that indicated they were partisan or were involved in electoral politics. And by the way, you do not need IRS permission to be a 501c4. You may self-declare.
Well, that's David K., just one more question to you for now. A lot of people are asking, why are groups like Crossroads GPS, which is a group founded by, you know, former George W. Bush administration, a top political advisor to the George W. Bush administration, Karl Rove, or the liberal group Priorities USA, are tax exempt when people would say, well, of course they're engaged in partisan political activity. So why is that?
I don't believe that they should be under the rules. This dates back earlier than they are. Karl Rove's organization's tax return shows that it spent in one recent year 99.9% of its money on politics and 0.1% on social welfare. That clearly is neither exclusively nor primarily. Congress needs to fix this. And I have a column today in Tax Notes magazine saying we can fix this with 8 little words.
You want to tell us what those 8 little words are?
And that are barred from partisan political activity.
Okay, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But let me bring Brenton Mock into the conversation. Your article in Color Alliance is titled, Why Are Nonprofits Banned from Politicking to Begin With? What did you find when you looked into that question?
Well, in doing my research about this, I noticed that one particular Tea Party group called True the Vote that I did a lot of reporting on last year was one of the loudest complainers about basically the IRS holding up their 501c3 application to be a nonprofit. And when I looked into the research of or the history of how it came to be that 501c3s were prohibited from political campaigning or electioneering, I came across an article from the Boston College Law Review. And it basically pointed to 1954 when Lyndon B. Johnson was a senator for Texas. And what he was trying to do there was fight back a threat from right-wing extremists who were using nonprofits to funnel millions of dollars to prop up candidates, right-wing extremist candidates against Lyndon B. Johnson in his reelection campaign for Senate. And so basically he went to Congress and he put in what's, you know, today called the Johnson Amendment in 1954. And that was the amendment that put an explicit prohibition on political campaigning on 501c3 nonprofits.
So what's the logic there? And your point is what? This is sort of born in politics? So do you by politics, you die by politics?
I think, you know, the prohibitions that were passed then, it's for the same threats that are posed today, which is, you know, wealthy right-wing extremists funneling money through these nonprofits. I mean, what Karl Rove is doing with Crossroads GPS is the same thing that was happening in Lyndon B. Johnson's day. And, you know, it puts the balance of power out of whack. And, you know, it had Lyndon B. Johnson not stepped in to do something like that, we would have had some really serious anti-Semites, McCarthyites, segregationists who would have been propped up by millionaires and corporations and using the nonprofits to do that.
You, Brenton, I obviously know, obviously Color Lines has a particular point of view, but do you think that this is primarily an issue of the right, people on the right using these levers to promote their own agendas? I mean, couldn't you make an argument that these levers would be used by anybody who figured it out?
Yeah, I mean, in 1954, it was directly from conservative groups, and again, extreme right-wing conservative groups who were utilizing this. Now, obviously, today, there are a number of groups who have set up 501c3s and 501c4s, both on the left and the right, and, you know, it all deserves scrutiny. I'm not making any kind of argument that, you know, that the IRS was justified in sorting out only conservative groups. Obviously, that scrutiny should apply to both liberals and conservatives.
To that end, David K. Johnston, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about the IRS scandal, and we're talking about what is the history of these tax exemption rules for nonprofits. Our guests are journalists David K. Johnston and Brenton Mock, who've both written about this. David K. Johnston, you also wrote a piece in the Columbia Journalism Review titled "The Other IRS Scandal." You say that the agency's drowning. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, in the last 10 years, as the population's grown and inflation has eroded the value of money, the IRS has been shrunk in real terms 17%, and its workload has been increased very significantly through all of these social welfare programs and non-tax programs that have been assigned to the IRS. It simply does not have the resources to do the job. Now, if you're a wage earner, you're not affected by this. That's an automated system. The money comes out of your pay before you get it. But people who own businesses, people who are investors, who are landlords, people who are sole proprietors, freelancers, they are basically under a separate tax system that is not being policed. And there's rampant cheating going on in that area, and nothing is being done about it. And by the way, just one thing Brandon said. There were 300 groups set aside for additional scrutiny of their applications for 501c4 status. 75 of those were 912, that's Glenn Beck's outfit, Tea Party, Patriot, Constitutional Education. Three quarters of them, the other 200 plus, were a whole variety of groups, some of them liberal, all sorts of different things. So this was not just selecting groups because they were in the Tea Party. It was selecting groups because their applications suggested they weren't really social welfare organizations. Using a name like Tea Party is the same thing as the police stopping young men in the street based on the color of their skin. It's wrong. Even if that young man should be stopped, it is wrong to select him on the basis of the color of his skin. It's wrong to pick someone on the basis of the name of their organization.
David K. Johnston, talk a little bit more about the fix to this, if you think there is. And I'm also curious about why it is that other groups haven't complained.
Well, some of them have. The tax exemption of a Democrat training organization was – Democratic Party training organization was 2 years ago taken away by the IRS. And there's very little scrutiny going on here. If you applied for this status and you said our group is here to promote resettlement of refugees or planting wildflowers, they just stamped your application. It was when you filled it out in a way that said, you know, we're going to be involved in political activity. That mandates under Congress's rules that the IRS investigate. And so it's troublesome that people found that scrutiny on its face difficult. The problem is, of course, they asked all sorts of inappropriate questions they shouldn't have asked. And I think it's important to remember the inspector general who reported on this, George Russell, is a former Republican staff aide. He was appointed by President Bush. All of this took place on the watch of Commissioner Douglas Shulman, an appointee of President George W. Bush. So those people out there saying, and I've seen several news accounts to this effect, that this was an Obama administration and Obama political campaign effort to do opposition research, that is just ridiculous nonsense.
And finally, David K. Johnson, you had your eight words that you say would fix this. Tell us why that, how that would fix this.
Because we would eliminate partisan political activity for this and go back to the idea, which is if you're advocating for a social welfare cause, you ought to be able to go to your city council or state legislature or Congress and say, here's what we're trying to do. But you shouldn't be able to use your tax-favored status to promote political candidates. And I'm virtually an absolutist on the First Amendment. I've stood up for people during my career whose views I found utterly detestable. But this isn't the issue here. The issue here is tax favors. And they should not be involved, I think, when you're doing political office and partisan politics. It should be issues that you're dealing with.
Brenton, do you have a final thought?
I do. I have a little bit of pushback on that. I mean, profiling is wrong, but I would argue that a lot of Tea Party groups profile themselves. You know, I mean, by the fact that their name is Tea Party, they invited a certain level of scrutiny, and most certainly they flouted tax laws. They most certainly worked on behalf of Republican parties and Republican candidates. And, you know, in that case, the IRS wasn't guilty of doing anything tyrannical. I mean, I think their biggest flaw was that they just weren't transparent about what they were doing. I mean, this wasn't a...
And Brandon, I agree. I agree.
All right, we have to leave it there for now. Brenton Mock is a reporter for ColorAlliance.com. David K. Johnston is a columnist for Tax Analysts, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, and president of the nonprofit group Investigative Reporters and Editors. His latest book is titled The Fine Print. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Now we'd like to talk about the changing face of poverty in this country. In a few minutes, we'll hear about poverty among Asian Americans. It turns out that the rate of poverty in that admittedly large and diverse population might be surprising when you're used to hearing a very different story. It also may surprise you to know that more poor Americans now live in suburbs than cities. So we'll focus on that first. You might have heard about Montgomery County, Maryland. It's just outside Washington, D.C. It's one of the wealthiest counties in the country. But Wendy Anderson, who works for a nonprofit that works with low-income people in Montgomery County, says she's seeing much more demand for the kinds of services her group provides.
They're not just coming in needing help with food assistance or shelter. We're actually seeing a rise in domestic violence issues, child abuse, neglect, immigration is a big thing right now, medical health insurance is a big thing.
A new book out today titled Confronting Suburban Poverty describes this phenomenon. Elizabeth Kneebone is the lead author, and she's with us now from our Washington, D.C. studios. Elizabeth, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So when did poverty in the suburbs, when and how, I guess is my question, did poverty in the suburbs become so noticeable?
Well, actually, it's been decades during which the poor population in suburbs has grown faster than in cities, since the 1980s, really.
And this is well before the current economic crisis, recession, whatever we want to call it.
That's right. Decades worth of this trend sort of gradually unfolding over time. But what's really striking about the 2000s is the magnitude of the increase and the pace at which we saw this growth picking up. So between 2000 and 2011, the number of poor in suburbs grew by 64%. That's more than twice the rate of growth that we saw in cities, faster than rural areas or other communities across the country.
And why is that? I think what you just said there is particularly striking, faster than both rural areas and the cities. And I think that people might find this surprising because they're used to hearing certain storylines, like, for example, Detroit, like the collapse of the auto industry or the withdrawal of certain kinds of jobs from city areas. But I think most people would have assumed that those jobs, if they went anywhere, went to the suburbs. So why the suburbs?
Well, and that's the thing that I think presents a certain challenge about how do we grapple with suburban poverty is this has happened so rapidly and our perceptions are still a bit outdated. They've lagged behind the pace of growth that we've seen these trends unfolding. And if you think about why is poverty growing in suburbs, it's either more low-income families and residents moving to suburban communities or longer-term residents slipping down the economic ladder. And generally, it's a combination of both of those factors. And, you know, the suburbs are also where jobs are moving. For years, we've seen jobs suburbanize in regions across the country, so move away from city centers and further out into metro regions. And jobs that pay lower wages, like construction or retail, are among the most suburbanized. And so is manufacturing, which is an industry that's been hit really hard over the last decade.
So you're saying that there are more people who are low income, more poor people moving into the suburbs. What about people in the suburbs slipping into poverty who were not previously there? Is that's also happening?
That is also happening. And that's where we can look to different economic factors that are the sort of downward pressure on families that may have lived in suburbs forever. And that can be two things. You look at the two downturns that we had in the last decade. The one at the beginning of the 2000s, which was shallower and shorter, but then we ended, you know, the 2000s with the worst recession since the Great Depression that sent poverty to record levels in this country in terms of the number of poor living in the U.S. And those changes were felt particularly in suburban communities because some of the hardest hit industries in the Great Recession were these more suburbanized types of jobs like construction, like services, like manufacturing.
Is there something that characterizes poverty in the suburbs that you would want to call to our attention? I mean, I think people understand the concept, you know, that rural poverty can be particularly grinding because there just aren't that many types of jobs to do. But in the suburbs, we think of the suburbs as having, I don't know, kind of diversified economies, for example, different kinds of jobs. You know, if you can't work at the Gap, then maybe you can work at Old Navy or something. You know what I mean? So is there something about that characterizes poverty in the suburbs that you think is particularly important to note from perhaps a policy standpoint?
What is perhaps unique about poverty in the suburbs? You know, it's not easy to be poor anywhere. You know, people struggle with the day-to-day realities of trying to get by and making ends meet. But in suburban communities, particularly ones where this is a recent phenomenon and a particularly rapid phenomenon, they often don't have the same sorts of services and infrastructure in place to address the challenges that come along with a growing poor population.
Well, I'll give you an example. Are you saying that perhaps a city might have a food bank or a city might have a sort of a mechanism for people dealing with an immediate crisis? Like they might have some funds to kind of give people an emergency rental payment or something. And you're saying that's less likely to be the case in the suburbs?
That's right. We see that the safety net, particularly nonprofit sort of services that have been built up in cities over decades of dealing with these challenges, are often less present in suburban communities. The safety net in suburbs is stretched much thinner. It's much patchier in terms of the kinds of services that might be available. And often, you know, suburban residents may not even know what services are there or accessible to them, especially if they're not visible or present in the community.
You also talked in the book, though, about efforts between cities that tend to have more experience with this and suburbs who have less experience with this, trying to collaborate across kind of geographic boundaries. We see this in the Washington, D.C. area. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. One example of this is if you look at the Seattle region and the south suburbs in particular and the south side of Seattle that have been grappling with not even just a rapid rise in suburban poverty, but also a diversifying community. In the south suburbs, they have in-movers from the city itself, from refugee populations from abroad, immigration. They have, you know, movement from other parts of the region. So it's a really diversifying and changing place that is also struggling with rising need. And one of the ways this has presented itself is the schools are often on the front lines of these trends. So making sure that there are the right services in place to help these students adapt, to help them achieve and close the stark education gaps that exist in these communities today, was a sort of call to action for a number of school districts, seven school districts in the south side of Seattle and in the school system in the south part of Seattle itself, working together to create what's called the Roadmap Project to look at a continuum, a cradle-to-career continuum of services to help kids achieve and to help put them on a path that gives them an opportunity and a way to work their way out of poverty.
Can I ask you a sticky question? You know, based on your reporting of this situation, I can imagine a scenario where people move to these areas in order to get away from those kinds of conversations. They don't necessarily want to have an economically diverse environment, right? Precisely because part of the motivation for people moving there was to say, I'd like to have a classroom environment where the kids are all like my kid, where we're all on the same page, where our values are the same, where I don't have to think about reduced price lunch and all that other stuff. I mean, are you finding that to be part of the issue here?
You know, when we say suburbs, we tend to think of one kind of thing, like it's one place. You know, it's an affluent middle class sort of cookie cutter leave it to beaver image. In reality, suburbs are a diverse and fragmented array of places. And just like there's no one type of suburb, there's no one type of experience of suburban poverty or response to it. So we absolutely have seen this issue where, A, it may be a lack of information to understand how your community has changed, that you do have free and reduced price lunch students in your school. And in fact, suburban students on free and reduced price lunch, that's a population that's been growing faster than in the cities as well. So this is already in communities that may not realize that it's there. But you see a diversity in terms of awareness and political will to do something about it.
That was Elizabeth Kneebone. She is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. That's a research group in Washington, D.C., a think tank, if you will. She is the lead author of the book Confronting Suburban Poverty in America, and she joined us in Washington, D.C. Elizabeth Kneebone, thank you for speaking with us.
Thanks again for having me.
Now we have another perspective on poverty in a place you might not expect to find it, or rather among a group of people. May is Asian American Heritage Month, and over the course of the month, you might have heard it said that Asian Americans enjoy the highest income and level of educational attainment of any racial group in this country. So it might surprise you to know that Asian Americans also experience a higher rate of poverty than non-Hispanic whites. According to a National Academy of Sciences analysis of census data, Asian Americans have a 12.3% poverty rate that compares to 9.8% for non-Hispanic whites. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called Algernon Austin. He is the director of the Race, Ethnicity, and the Economy Program at the Economic Policy Institute. That's here in Washington, D.C. He's written about the issue for the Institute. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us, Rosalind Chow. She's a sociology professor at Georgia State University. She's also co-author of the book, The Myth of the Model Minority, Asian Americans Facing Racism. Welcome to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Mr. Austin, I'll start with you. The Pew Center found that Asian Americans have a significantly higher median income than the general population, $66,000 a year compared to just under $50,000. The first question, you know, that comes to mind is, how is it possible that the median income is higher, but there's still a significant poverty rate?
Well, the Asian American population is quite diverse, and there are many highly educated Asian Americans, but the actual Asian American population that does not have a high school diploma is actually higher than the white rate. So you also have significant numbers of low-wage earners among Asian Americans.
Is it mainly educational attainment, or are there other common factors like geography, for example?
Oh, well, geography matters a great deal because Asian Americans are also concentrated in some of the highest cost of living cities. So about a third of the Asian American population lives in New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. And those cities have a quite high cost of living. So actually, when you take into account the cost of living, the Asian American poverty rate is about 2.5 percentage points higher than the official rate.
Professor Chow, why don't you pick up the thread there as well? Are there people from certain countries who are more likely to be poor than people from other countries, or are there other commonalities among Asian Americans who tend to be poor, who are living in poverty?
The thing about the Asian American group is that it encompasses over 50 nations, and then there are different ethnicities involved in that as well. So it's a large group that's lumped together. And with that, there are different types of immigration that have happened that affect whether they're refugee status or they came over for educational purposes or work purposes. So with that, Cambodian, Lao, Hmong, Vietnamese, they're largely immigrated to the U.S. via political or refugees because of war. And in that case, their circumstances are different that would affect their educational attainment and their income levels.
What have you found as the sort of the defining factor? Is it refugee status, or is that generally the main reason that people tend to be poor?
In my research, I've also found that the Hmong, in discussing education and culture with them, my Hmong respondent said in their culture it wasn't valued over family and agriculture. And what you'll find in the Midwest, the Hmong population, there's a lot of ginseng farming, not that push for educational attainment. And just in general, those groups still don't overshadow the fact that even East Asian descent Asian Americans have higher rates of poverty and still higher rates of not having high school education, sure. less than high school education as well.
Mr. Austin, you just mentioned that a third of Asian Americans live in some of the most expensive places in the country, New York City, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. You started to tell us why that factors into these poverty rates. Does that mean that if these people lived somewhere else, they wouldn't be poor? Or is it that people are concentrated in places where poverty is more prevalent anyway? What's the impact of that?
The impact is simply cost of living. So by the official poverty rate, the Asian American poverty rate is higher than the non-Hispanic white poverty rate. But that official rate does not take into account cost of living. And when you factor in the fact that it costs more to live in San Francisco than in Topeka, Kansas, for example, then you see that those rates are considerably higher. One important factor in the poverty rate that we see, the high poverty rates, goes back to what I said before, that there are significant numbers of Asian Americans who did not complete a high school diploma. So that's a factor. The other thing to keep in mind, even at the high end, when you compare Asian Americans individually by educational attainment, you still see that they earn less than non-Hispanic white males, for example. Particularly at the high school level, there's a significant difference. So white men earn about 10,000 more than Asian men with just a high school diploma.
Hmm. You know, Professor Chow, your book is called The Myth of the Model Minority, which suggests that there really isn't perhaps a general understanding that poverty exists among Asian Americans. Do you think that there's some consequence to that?
Absolutely. So the first consequence is externally people not realizing that there are issues with this racial group. Then in my research, I found that many Asian Americans were discouraged to talk about any problems they had that had to do with perhaps racial discrimination, that families even encouraged their children to not say anything and don't rock the boat. That was the term that came up over and over again. I had an example on a college campus where a group of Asian students wrote a report on the state of Asian American affairs on campus, and even Asian Americans on campus, they were the biggest backlash because they didn't want to say, oh, we're not a problem minority. We don't have it as bad as, say, this group or that group, so why are you drawing attention to our issues and we don't have any?
Mr. Austin, I did want to ask about that. I mean, even though Asian American poverty is higher than that of non-Hispanic whites, it's still lower than other significant minorities in this country among African Americans and Hispanics. So given that, can you argue that this ought to be a priority? And if so, how? How should we be talking about this?
I mean, I think we're a rich country and we should do more to address poverty across the board. The issue for Asian Americans is because there's a high median family income, this issue is it's harder to get the resources and the services to low-income Asian American communities. And also, when you break it down by specific ethnic groups, the Hmong, the Bangladeshi, they have poverty rates that rival the African American poverty rate.
Professor Chow, a final thought from you about what kinds of ways would be productive to talk about this? Can you think of conversations that we should be having about this that would be constructive?
We have to get past the notion of being in a post-racial society, and that for Asian Americans, while poverty rates across the board as a group don't look as bad as perhaps other racial groups, that there are consequences to living in a country with a racial hierarchy. The mental health rates are alarming in terms of depression and suicide.
Rosalind Chow is a sociology professor at Georgia State University. She was with us from member station WABE in Atlanta. Algernon Austin is the director of the Race, Ethnicity, and the Economy Program at the Economic Policy Institute. He was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. You might remember our next guest from her star-making turn on the Fox TV reality show MasterChef. If you watched it, you probably remember her perfect apple pie or the Vietnamese dishes her mother taught her that ultimately won her the title. And it's Asian American Heritage Month, and one of the ways our next guest shows her pride in that heritage is through her cooking. Oh, and you might remember, she's also legally blind. If you don't, here's a clip of her MasterChef audition with Chef Gordon Ramsay.
In the history of MasterChef, we've never had a blind contestant. Welcome.
Thank you.
What are you cooking?
I'm cooking Vietnamese comfort food. It's a catfish braised in a clay pot, and I pickled vegetables to go with it.
Okay, Christine, you've got 5 minutes to complete that dish. Christine?
Yes, Chef?
Were you born blind?
No, Chef. Maybe about 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune condition that affected my nerves, my spinal cord, and my optic nerves, and so I lost my vision gradually over the past 10 years.
Well, after all of that grilling, Christine Ha came out on top in season 3, winning the $250,000 prize, and now she's just out with her first cookbook, Recipes from My Home Kitchen, Asian and American Comfort Food, and she is with us now. Welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So how does it feel to after all you've done since then to listen back to that first interview, those first couple days on MasterChef?
It still kind of gives me chills down my spine. It's just interesting to try to tap back into that memory because it seems so long ago, but then it's not. And it's just I feel like life has changed a lot since then for me.
Has it gone into hyperdrive in a way?
Yes, definitely. It feels like it's been nonstop since the show has been airing. It's definitely been exciting, and life is different.
How did you decide what you wanted to focus on for your first cookbook?
I think that I really thought about the sorts of recipes that I liked to cook on the show, what did well. I knew that a lot of people were curious about what sort of recipes I made on the show, and they would want to recreate it at home. So I definitely wanted to include the recipes that I made successfully. And it's a lot of comfort food. At the end of the day, that's my favorite type of food to eat. And so I think that's a good representation of my culinary style. So that's what I wanted to have in my first cookbook.
Well, I think a lot of people are familiar with what we consider American comfort food, and you feature recipes like spaghetti and meatballs, although I always think it's funny that people consider spaghetti to be an American comfort food, but we'll just but that is true. But you also have recipes that you call Asian comfort food. And I think it's kind of poignant, if you don't mind my mentioning here, that you dedicate the book to your parents, and especially, as you say in the book, my mother, who lives on through me and these recipes. Your mother passed away when you were 14. Can you talk a little bit about how she influenced you?
Yes. Yeah, so I grew up eating her food, obviously, at home, and I was an only child. And I just took it for granted, as many children do about their childhoods. I just thought that good food by your mother was just something that everyone had at home. And it wasn't until she passed away that I realized I really missed her cooking and the food that I grew up eating. And I didn't know how to cook, and I never really followed her around in the kitchen at all growing up. I thought I would just have time later in life to learn cooking from her. And it wasn't until I went to college that I really thought about the food that I grew up eating, and I really missed it. And so I decided to buy a cookbook and try from there, and then eventually think about the sorts of foods that she made and how she made it and the ingredients that went into it and the little twists that she would put into certain dishes. And I tried to do the same. And that's how I came up with a lot of recipes that are influenced by her.
You know, I think your story will probably resonate with a lot of people from different backgrounds, you know, not just immigrant backgrounds, where you kind of don't really appreciate what you have until it's gone. Because you also talk in the book about how you used to try to trade your mom's Vietnamese egg rolls for your classmates' spaghetti. I'm sure that, I mean, I don't know, that's so funny that you kind of, I think a lot of us would be fighting over those egg rolls now.
Yeah, now I don't think I would hoard those like crazy. I even hoard them now when I make it myself.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with TV's MasterChef Christine Ha. She writes a blog called The Blind Cook. She's just out with her first cookbook after winning season 3 on MasterChef, which is on Fox TV. You also give some I can't help but notice you give some sort of inside information about what it was like to compete on the program, which I found really interesting. And again, I think applicable to people, even if they aren't competing on an intense reality show. Talk about the salmon, if you would, the whole thing with the salmon, how you wanted to make one thing, but then you got kind of you threw yourself off. You kind of psyched yourself out. Do you want to tell that story?
Yeah. So I think that was actually a really strong turning point for me. So we had this challenge where Felix, who was the winner of the previous challenge, got to assign each of us a fish to cook with. And she and I are friends, and we're still very good friends. And on the show, you know, she even says, like, I love Christine. That's why I'm giving her the salmon, this big, beautiful pink salmon that's fresh. And I myself love salmon sashimi. So I thought, okay, well, I should serve it up somehow raw because that's the way I like to eat it. But in my head, I did psych myself out, and I thought, well, the judges are going to say I don't have any technique if I just slice up a fish and don't apply any heat to it. So I went against my instincts and decided to cook the salmon, which I myself don't like to personally eat. And it ended up being disastrous. It was overcooked. I didn't even like it myself. I was unhappy with the dish. The judges did get me on that. And I think after that, I really thought about it, and I was defiant against like any possibility of that happening again in the future. So I told myself that from that point on, I was always going to cook whatever I would want to eat myself and that I could stand behind and defend wholeheartedly no matter what. And I think that was the turning point where I felt like I could finally trust my intuition from that point on.
How do you think a home cook could apply that lesson?
I think that food can be very subjective. I think sometimes home cooks get intimidated by what other people are telling them they should and shouldn't like. At the end of the day, it's really about what you like to eat, and don't worry so much about how other people perceive your food. But if you like to eat it, then by all means, I think that's really the way to follow your instincts. And I think that's a way to cook from your heart and cook with true passion is when you really believe in the food that you're cooking. So don't worry so much about what other people think.
I wonder if that also applies to kind of the fancy factor, which is that maybe because food has become such a big thing in this country that people are intimidated about just enjoying simple things and feel that they have to be, you know, super fancy in order to feel like they're cooking, maybe?
Yeah, you know? No, I completely agree. I completely agree because I think... that's exactly why I sort of wanted to turn it around with my cookbook, and I wanted to make food accessible again to the home cook. You know, a lot of those things are great, but it's not what you're doing when you come home after, you know, 9 hours of work and you have kids and a spouse to feed, and you don't want to be pulling out like the crazy fancy stuff or having to brown the top of like some dish or whatever with these crazy equipments or using liquid nitrogen or making things into foam or whatever. And,
right.
And that's not
that
to knock people that
do
that.
I was going to say, what? You don't do that when you get home? You pull out your home torch and like
yeah, and it's not to knock people that do that. You know, that's all great too. But I, you know, I myself personally, that's not my normal cooking style at home.
When we last spoke, you said that if you won the contest, you were going to open or you wanted to open an ice cream shop with creative flavors. And you were also thinking about a gastropub in your hometown of Houston. So what's happened with those plans? Anything?
Yeah. So actually, I'm trying to move forward with the gastropub. I have a formal business plan put together. I'm putting that through the banks to see how much I can qualify for funding. And we might seek some outside partners and investors. And I'm trying to make that happen probably within the next year or so. So that would be another dream come true.
Well, a shame about the ice cream shop not being open yet because Memorial Day is coming up. And that's a good time for people to enjoy some pie and ice cream along with some, you know, barbecue and things. So do you have something in the cookbook? What do you recommend for Memorial Day?
Oh, for Memorial Day. Well, Memorial Day is when people start breaking out with their grills. So there's a few recipes that use the grill in my cookbook. One that's super simple and delicious is the teriyaki chicken and pineapple skewers. And that just puts an Asian twist on what you would think of as a typical American barbecue. So that gives a little bit of a Japanese flavor to it. And also I have the grilled beef short ribs, which is Korean in nature. And that's something that my in-laws actually cook for all of our birthdays all the time. And it's great because it's also not too difficult, but it's very, very delicious, and it smells great. And those are things that you can just pop on the grill and impress your guests.
Okay. Well, we want to do that, too. We want to keep it simple, but we also want to impress our guests. I mean, who are we kidding, right, Jeff? You know, before we let you go, I noted that as Gordon Ramsay certainly didn't mince words at the beginning of the interview with you, asking you about your site, just thinking about how you think about yourself now. I know that your blog was called The Blind Cook, and so you certainly don't shy away from it, but you also make clear you don't want to be a gimmick. But you do want to be an inspiration. And I'm interested in just, you know, how you think about those things now.
That's a really good question. I don't necessarily think that people should always come up to me and find it amazing that I'm able to put on my own makeup or that I'm able to chop an onion by myself. But I understand, too, that those things can be inspiring. So I think if anything, I want people to take away from it that, you know, wow, she can get over this obstacle and achieve her dreams. That's the bigger picture, and that's the more important thing that I would want others to see and understand that I really think people have more inside themselves than they give themselves credit for and more strength than they know. And it's only when you're really put to that test that you really can see yourself overcome it. And I just want people to know that it's possible for everyone.
Christine Ha's new cookbook is called Recipes from My Home Kitchen. She was kind enough to join us from our New York bureau. Chef Ha, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now we're going to flip the channel and turn to another hit television show. The ABC program Scandal just wrapped up its second season in a blaze of plot-twisted glory. If you're late to the game, there are going to be some spoilers here and there, but here's a clip from the finale.
Hello, Olivia.
Dad.
Now, even if you don't watch the show, chances are you can't get away from it on Twitter and other social media platforms, especially when it airs on Thursday evenings. We wanted to talk about why this show gets so much social media attention, especially from African Americans. So we've called Gene Demby. He wrote about this in a blog for NPR's Code Switch team, and he's with us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Gene, welcome back.
Thanks, Michelle. Thanks for having me again.
So a lot of people are talking about Black Twitter, and they're saying that this has played a major role in the success of Scandal. What is Black Twitter, and is it true?
So Black Twitter is this jokey appellation that Black people have given their own little universe on Twitter. So Black people make up 14% of the population, but they make up a quarter of all the people on Twitter. So if Black people have a fascination around something, it becomes a megaphone. So if Serena Williams is playing like in the Wimbledon finals, let's say, it becomes a trending topic really quickly. And so Black television watchers have really, really galvanized around Scandal for a bunch of different reasons.
You're saying that watching Scandal is a communal experience. You're saying it's a deeply edifying, profoundly communal experience, and it just isn't the same if you watch it by yourself a day later. Why is that?
It's like watching the Super Bowl on DVR, right? You want to be in the room with everyone kind of yelling at the screen and rolling their eyes and throwing their hands up and saying all kind of snarky stuff, right? And that's how it is to watch Scandal, right? At the center of the show, there's this gorgeous, accomplished woman played by Kerry Washington named Olivia Pope. And there's so many ways to receive her. She's either like an anti-hero, or she's the person we all want to be when we grow up, or the person we all want to marry one day, or whoever. And so everyone is kind of wrestling with all these things that she's doing.
And why do you think that this kind of social media gathering, this communal watching experience has contributed to the success of the program? Because it kind of guarantees eyeballs, people sitting there at the moment that the show is on the air. Is that why?
Yes, absolutely. You're having conversations with people that you don't know, which is always happens on Twitter. But for Black people on Twitter, I think there's a chance to kind of work out a lot of issues, or like kind of have debates in a space that it's not these aren't political debates, but these are definitely debates about the kind of stuff we all deal with, right? Relationships and whether things are appropriate. And, you know, it's just a fun, ridiculous time, and it feels like it goes by too quickly.
You also pointed out in your piece that the creator of the show, Shonda Rhimes, is an African-American you know, woman herself. Do you think that that's part of it?
Oh, that's a big part of it. I mean, Kerry Washington, who is the star of the show, is the first Black woman to be the lead of a network drama in almost three decades. And Shonda Rhimes is the most powerful woman probably on network television. And so I think there is some element of solidarity happening around this. But it speaks a lot to the paucity of Black faces on TV, that people feel a kind of kinship to the show and want it to do well. But just wanting it to do well is has not propelled other shows the same way. So there's something about Scandal. There's Olivia, who is a fixer for this white Republican president, and they're having an affair, right? And so what's interesting about that is that there's a critical mass of black women rooting for a white Republican who stole an election and the woman he's having an affair with. That's a very fascinating little phenomenon.
Well, one of the things I also notice is you'd think that, okay, there's an African-American female creator of the show. There's an African-American female lead of the show, but you are neither. You are not. You are African-American, but you are not a woman. And on Twitter, I've noticed that it's a lot of men are weighing in too. Do you find that it goes across groups?
It's almost like you have to watch Scandal to be culturally fluent almost. I mean, you have to, in order to be able to have a water cooler conversation the next day, you have to know that Olivia and Fitz are a mess, right? And you have to know why they're a mess. It's like the day after the Super Bowl, you don't want the person like, oh, I really enjoyed the commercials. Like, if you know, I mean, you can have that conversation, but you need to be tuned in to have that conversation.
Give me an example of some of the tweets that caught your eye. Do you mind? Like, well, some of the things that people have tweeted about that really caught your attention, or even who?
The other day, it was funny watching Gwen Ifill of PBS and Michelle Norris of NPR kind of having this conversation about Scandal. And we're like, girl, I mean, it's just like my aunties and my professors and my colleagues and my little cousins are all engaging in the same cultural moment. It was a lot of fun.
Do other groups do this? Have you observed this phenomenon among other groups?
You know, I actually, my hunch is, and this is just me taking a guess, that there's a lot of stuff like that happening on Spanish language Twitter when people are speaking in different languages. But Black Twitter tends to kind of galvanize around a few moments every year. But Scandal feels like a major pop cultural moment, like an award show every Thursday.
Finally, before we, you know, okay, if you don't mind my saying, Gene, I get the feeling you don't really like the show. I get the feeling you kind of hate yourself for liking it so much. Do I have that right? Have I clued into something?
At first, when I watched it, I was kind of hate watching it, right? It was definitely like, this is ridiculous, this is preposterous. But then I realized I was just watching it wrong. I was just watching it, like, expecting it
like
to
a journalist.
Right, exactly.
Expecting stuff to be true.
Expecting it to be plausible, right? Instead of just being like, you know, Kerry Washington is fine, she's fly, right? Instead of being like, this is purple and fun and ridiculous and just letting it all wash over me. I was like, once I got to kind of resolve to just watch it for
the
what
willful
it is,
suspension of disbelief.
Absolutely. And just
for
kind
an
of
hour,
have
right.
the conversation with other people. It just became a much more enjoyable experience.
That was Gene Demby. He's a blogger for NPR's Code Switch team. Thanks, Gene.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.